Welcome to the Media Cat Magazine podcast. I'm your host, Mike Pigger, editor at the magazine. And for the pod today, I'd like to welcome Bob Sheard, co-founder of brand design agency Fresh Britain. Welcome, Bob.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Good to speak to you. And off mic, we were chatting about Gladiator 2 just before we get into the conversation. Yeah, and I just wanted to say, how was Gladiator? Was it good for you?
I think the first half an hour was good and the last hour was good and I fell asleep in between. So I'm going to need to go back.
You heard it here first. I just thought I'd throw a curveball in there right at the start. We're obviously not going to be discussing films per se, but I thought I'd like to talk about that. Yeah, I heard there's sharks involved or something, but yeah, I don't know if you were awake for that bit. Apparently there's just some sharks, I don't know.
My Saturday night caught up with me on Sunday evening.
Well, we'll try and ease you into the podcast styles. It's obviously a Monday morning at the moment. But we're going to discuss kind of your career and all things brand design, really. And I imagine you've done this many times before, but I wondered if we could kind of go back to the start and just sort of start with how did you get into the world of marketing and then I suppose specifically brand design?
I suppose the genesis story starts when I was about 14. I was attended a pretty industrial comprehensive school in Halifax, and I was quite small, got quite badly bullied in the first few years. And then I used to work on the markets in Bradford for my family. They're also market traders selling tights and socks and things like that. I earned a bit of money. Found myself in the Afflex Palace in Manchester, bought myself a pair of Adidas Lendl courts, and was probably the first person to wear those in Yorkshire, certainly the first person to wear those in my school. And I was kind of armor plated. For some reason, the attention I stopped getting was not bullying anymore, but people were interested in my sneakers. And that kind of opened up a whole world of magic in terms of how brands and fashion in a way can transform, materially transform the outcome. And so just got very interested in that, really. Became slightly obsessed with vintage denim. I used to buy and sell bales of denim from Oxfam, and I used to separate the jeans out and sell all the crap stuff in the Halifax market, Leeds market and Dewsbury market with my then girlfriend and my mother. And then we used to bring the good stuff, the Levi's, the Wranglers and the Lee, and we had a stall on Camden Market and used to sell that to the good people of London, but then sold the vintage back to Levi's, and they kind of could see I knew more about their vintage than they did, and they liked the cut of my jib. So Levi's then offered to pay for my education. So I did a product design degree at LCF, sponsored by Levi's, which then came full circle a few years ago when I did the whole redesign globally for Levi's. So it's quite a moment to go from a Camden Market stall to redesigning the whole brand and getting it to an IPO. So that's a quick journey through my journey.
Yeah, definitely. Sort of a flying study. Can you just focus in on how did Levi's approach you exactly? How did that work?
Well, the first time they approached me was me approaching them to sort of say, look, I've got an archive of vintage denim you should really own, and this is why. And then they kindly sponsored my degree. So I was really lucky in that I had a kind of access to a sample room, a PA and everything. So it made my life a lot easier. The second time they approached me was to design Levi's Made and Crafted, which is now Levi's Made, which is their premiumized line. So that was a really nice thing to do because that's kind of brand creation, but within an established brand. And then the third time is I got a call from the president of Levi's and his exact words were, can you come and unfuck Levi's? And I was just recovering from a bad snowboard injury that nearly killed me. I had a pulmonary embolism as a result of it. And so I couldn't travel. So I said, yeah, I'd love to come and unfuck Levi's, but you're going to have to come here because I can't travel. And so they all came over here. And over a period of a five-day session, we ended up with Living Levi's. That was the moniker that got them into their IPO.
I really hope like these things are on your bio. So, you know, like first guy to wear a pair of certain pair of Adidas trainers in Yorkshire and the guy that came along and unfucked Levi's. I really hope that's your bio.
Yeah, my tagline is don't come to me if you want to get fucked. I only unfuck.
It's pretty good. It's pretty good as a memorable line. So I suppose you're a big fan of denim then. I mean, you must have seen the rise and fall of denim every sort of 5 to 7 years or so.
Yeah, I'm obsessed with it. I mean, I think the reason why I love denim is it's not really changed, but it changes in terms of the more you wear it, it elegantly decays, and the sort of biography of the wearer is revealed as the products sort of moves into a more chaotic condition, and then the biography of the fabric also is revealed. So there's a kind of little symbiotic relationship between the wearer and the fabric that's unique to that product. I just love it.
Elegant decay sounds like a really nice term for perhaps a brand life cycle, or perhaps people maybe as well.
People more so than ever. I did a conference a couple of weeks ago, and I was asked the question, how do you make fashion sustainable? And once I'd answered the question, I got contacted by a woman that has a PR agency in New York and London, and she just said, can I speak to you privately? Because I couldn't speak to you at the event because I was so moved by what you said. And what I said was all about elegant decay. I said, if you want to make fashion sustainable, the first thing we've got to do as consumers is get real with terms of imperfection. We shouldn't be striving for perfection all the time. We shouldn't be striving for box fresh all the time. It should be okay for me to turn up with a hole in my jumper and that be seen and interpreted as a considered choice rather than the fact I'm skin. And so we should get to love patina, not in just products, but in people. And the simple reason is we don't love perfection. We respect it, but we do fall in love with imperfection because imperfection takes us closer to the gods that are the people we love and worship. It's like, you know, Djokovic is a metronome of perfection. He's respected but not loved. McEnroe is absolutely a celebration of imperfection, and we love him to bits because we see our frailties and our vulnerabilities expressed through him. And when we can do that in fashion and in products and with each other, then there's half a chance we can get rid of planned obsolescence and we can start to celebrate patina and imperfection and elegant decay.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of what they've been doing in the beauty industry in the last few years, in a way, sort of celebrating imperfections a lot more than perhaps they did, I don't know, 10, 20 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I've lobbied for a long time for the advertising industry to have a warning on any images that have been retouched to show people that they aren't, those images aren't real. They're not, you can't aspire to them because they're cartoons.
And now you've got to fight against AI retouching everything, or just complete AI imagery, I suppose.
Yeah, I'm hoping that we evolve to be able to see it. Mm. You know, we'll recognize it as not real, just like we do with CGI now. When we as a species will evolve to be able to recognize what is and what isn't.
Oh, yeah, I was arguing that about sort of AI bots and chatbots and helpers and stuff like that recently, and sort of just internally to colleagues, and sort of saying, I don't mind it if they have names that aren't human names, but it's when they're trying really hard to pretend to be human. I'd prefer it if they just pretend to be, you know, they just are what they are and just act like AI robots. They've got a robot-y name. I'd prefer that to sort of pretend to be, hi, I'm Dave, I'm your best friend. I'm like, I don't really want that. I'd like it to be flagged, you know? I don't know. Everybody thinks that.
It's the same with brands. I think as consumers, we generally arc towards the truth. And that's when we land authentically, whether it's in an AI situation. It has to be authentic and truthful as opposed to the other way around. And it's the same with brands. You ultimately bend towards its truth.
Just on a side note, this wasn't necessarily one of my questions, but I guess, you're a fan of the sort of pre-loved market, you know, the rise of sort of Depop and Vinted and all those kind of guys. What do you think of that sort of the rise of pre-love these days?
Yeah, I think it's part of the future. I think that one of the things that we will see in the future as we transition towards Generation Z and Alpha is we're going to see consumers that are going to be less defined by what they own and more defined by what they do. And that means brands have got to explore new ways and new pathways to growth that are beyond just making products, and the resale vintage is all part of that. You know, if you look at brands like and companies like Sellier in Monaco and London, that, you know, they're selling luxury, but doing it through the imperfection of pre-loved, and I think that's the way to go.
Yeah, it seems so. Jumping back a little bit again, because I think your career is fascinating. I just wondered, what did you learn from sort of working for like Converse and Caramore in the 90s? What was that time like?
What I learned at Converse is it was the first time I found it was an advantage to be bald, because I got a job there when I was 26, but they thought I was 36, so they kept promoting me and promoting me and promoting me. I was creative director at 28, and they didn't have a clue how old I was. But what I learned there, because I was in charge of all products, I was in charge of all clothing and footwear and all the marketing and comms for everywhere outside of Japan and America. And what I just learned there is all we're doing is telling stories. You're telling stories through the medium of the choices at hand. So you're telling stories through the medium of product design, and you're telling stories through the medium of communication design. And so it's just understanding that you have to integrate that storytelling through the different media. And that was a real pleasure to do that with Converse, because it's such a stunning brand with rich, rich history. And then I kind of went from there to Caramore. I was hired back out of Converse by Alessandro Benetton and Andrea Bonomi, whose investment fund, Investimenti Duecciuno, just bought Caramore. It was their first acquisition. So I was put in there on the board to polish it up for a sale, really. And so I'd gone from building a brand of enduring value to trying to create a brand of immediate value. And I had to very quickly get my head around what levers to pull to generate turnover, what levers to pull to generate profitability, and ultimately what levers to pull to generate value through the multiple. So that was amazing. I had 18 board meetings with those guys, and it was a roller coaster ride, but I thoroughly enjoyed it. Very grateful.
Was that kind of weird in your brain to do sort of a mental 180, or could you sort of draw on things you'd done at Converse and previously, do you think?
Yeah, I could draw on the storytelling, but the kind of critical part is to understand, okay, and people don't get this in brands. So if you're a goods company, up to 20% of your market cap is based on the value of your brand. That rises to 40% if you're a service company. Now, people in those organizations at the top of board level and CEO level don't understand which levers of their brand to pull to generate that kind of the value through turnover, through positioning, to generate profit through personality, to generate value through purpose. And so you gradually realize that no one understands it, so we've got to help them understand it. And then where it becomes a slightly more amazing thing is when you look at a national economy. The sum of a national economy is the sum of its goods and services. Effectively, by proxy, the sum of its brands. So it would really help on a national level as well, where the politicians understood what levers to pull and what levers to invest in and motivate to enhance brand value and then enhance national economic value. And that doesn't exist today. So that's what we're fighting to try and change.
We need some more sort of marketing-based people closer to politics, I'm guessing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you, it's part of what we're working with at the moment. We've just written a book that will be out in March, which is How Brands Can Save the World. And it's all about regenerative brand design. And we've got a three-book deal that the first book will create a undergraduate program in brand design. The second book will create a MBA program, and the third book will change PPE, politics, philosophy, and economics, and that will become creative politics, philosophy, and economics. And we're working with our partners at Central St. Martin's to make this real. But the whole point is that people from my background, from creative backgrounds, they haven't got a pathway through to the boardroom. So the first degree is to help that. People from creative backgrounds haven't got a pathway into CEO-dom. So we're creating a pathway for that. And what happens is normally the people in boardrooms and CEOs come from either the finance function, the commercial function, the legal function. And what they don't understand is the two most important things in brand is understanding how brands work and how they connect to consumers. So when they're in those positions, they take an often defensive position. Similarly, if you look at the composition of Parliament, 620-odd MPs, they're all soldiers and lawyers. So we only ever get legal and military solutions to things. There are no creatives there. So redesigning a degree for creative politics, philosophy, and economics will hopefully find a pathway for people from the creative industries into politics. Our role is to create kind of sleeper cells sleeper cells of regenerative brand designers that can go into politics and to go into other companies, the biggest companies in the world, and change them from within. We've got to change the way people think to change anything.
Well, now that you've called them sleeper cells, it just sounds really cool. So, you know, hopefully that I'm sold. Yeah, no, I mean, it's an interesting term. And definitely, I think a few years back when I was at the Marketing Society, many of our events were around, you know, how marketing can get closer to the boardroom, how they can work with, you know, CFOs, etc. So it sounds like it's an age-old problem that still needs heavily addressing.
It's just the evidence is there. If you get someone from the creative or the brand background into the position of CEO, you end up with a much more offensive outlook. It's like Anita Roddick at Body Shop, Phil Knight at Nike, Steve Jobs at Apple. When you come from that side of things, they understand the two most fundamentals, brand and consumer.
That makes sense. One of the things that I wanted to ask, because you sort of, correct me if I'm wrong, but you run Fresh Britain for 24 years now. And I wondered if you could sort of reflect on what sort of change you've seen in the marketing and media industry in that time. And I also wanted to ask you about back in the day, you got in a scrap with one of the Gallagher brothers as well, I believe. I'm curious about that.
Yeah, that was more of a misunderstanding.
But, okay.
I can go into that. In terms of what's changed and what hasn't changed, I'm not sure how many technological changes I've got left in me. You know, I don't know how many more phones I can cope with or shifts in software I can cope with. And I've always been a slightly Luddite when it comes to that sort of stuff. And so I've always gravitated towards the things that don't change. And in brand design, the things that don't change massively are the products. You know, what I'm wearing today, my grandparents would recognize as a sweatshirt and a pair of chinos. What you're wearing, your grandparents would recognize as a t-shirt and a pair of glasses. Those things don't really change. And it's the same with storytelling. The stories that we tell through our brands are kind of timeless. What has changed is the way we access those products and the way we access those stories. So marketing has changed, but brand design hasn't really changed. And so that's why I've sort of landed on it, because I prefer the timelessness of it rather than the time sensitiveness of it, of marketing and media and all that kind of thing. So those are the fundamentals that stay the same. When I was at Converse, I sponsored the backstage areas of the Reading Festival and the Phoenix Festival and Tea in the Park. And I suppose that was called opinion leader marketing. Today you'd call it influencer marketing, but basically you had all the journalists from London backstage and all the artists. And so I sponsored backstage just so I could clothe the artists in Converse shoes and talk to the journalists about what we were doing at Converse. And it was amazing. The whole deal was £14,000 to do that. And we had a stall at the front where we offered people Converse if they came and changed their sneakers. And we made about £40,000 on the store. So it was it was ridiculous at the time. Anyway, at Phoenix, it started to rain. And on the lineup that year was Ice-T and Cop Killers and Flavor Flav, who hate each other. They ended up coming into my tent to get out of the rain. So I had these vehement sort of enemies in the tent, and I just had one old guy who was an old rugby player doing the security, didn't stand a chance. So I was all a bit nervy, and I thought it was all going to kick off inside the tent. And this young lad came in and scruffy with this blonde, bedraggled girl asking for a pair of free trainers. And I just had someone else trying to con their way in. I told them where to go. And then I said to this young lad with a Manchester accent and his bedraggled blonde girlfriend, no. Come back later, but no, not now. And that was Noel. And so I had to run after him and apologize. Of course you can have some all-stars.
Oh dear. Did you experience the cultural phenomenon that everybody else did of queuing for Oasis tickets, or did you sidestep that one?
You know what? No, I totally sidestepped it. I can just envisage it, the crowd just being full of nearly retired posturing men. I can't be bothered with that.
probably. You talked about the sort of fundamental, the human fundamentals staying the same, and I just wondered what have been the sort of biggest impacts on brand design over the years? You know, sustainability things or sort of dealing with everything becoming digital? Or do you think it sort of doesn't have any impact and it still remains the same?
Yeah, I think like things like digital, which is the digital is the way we access the stories and where we access the products. So that I see that as that's a marketing function and hasn't really changed the sort of fundamentals of brand design. Brand design is going through, it's in the middle, it's on the cusp of a massive change now. I was at a fashion conference last week and it was stunning. It was beautifully produced. It was stunning. The people were amazing. The stories were great. But I felt like I was at the most beautifully curated steamship conference, but we're on the edge of the space era. And it was quite anachronistic. And fashion used to be ahead of consumers and it used to be ahead of brands. And as the world comes to terms with sustainable life on Earth, fashion is behind consumers. Consumers are ahead of fashion for the first time in my career. And they're ahead of other branded sectors as well. And what's changing brand design is this growing awareness that if you look at what we've experienced in the last 5 years, COVID, climate, conflict, there is no democratic lever for us to pull as citizens of the world to vote in who can manage those three things on a global level. We've just got 195 countries trying to manage things that ignore national boundaries from within their 195 national borders. So you've got 195 disintegrated entities trying to manage it with global institutions that were designed at the end of the Second World War, the UN, the World Bank, everything, that are not fit for purpose. So we've got this horrendous situation where it's impossible to see how we can manage effectively and in an integrated way, COVID, climate, and conflict. The only thing we can do as consumers is buy the change we want to see, is to buy. Our only democratic expression is how we spend our money. So we're going to buy brands that represent the future we want to live in, that represent the change we want to see, which throws into real focus the importance of brands moving forward. I mean, they are evolving meaning systems in the same way that religion was a meaning system and monarchy was a meaning system. They're evolving meaning systems that people wear and use to express their own values. And so it brings into real focus the importance of brands moving forward and how they can change things. As the consumers shift from being defined by what they own, which is my consumer, you know, buy a Range Rover, show you how rich I am, procreate with me, your children won't go hungry, I'm a good hunter, that sort of thing, Darwinist, status-driven consumption, to being more defined by what they do, means that there's an opportunity for brands to shift from growth pathways that are about making things to growth pathways that are about selling intelligence, experience, knowledge. I was looking for historical precedent to see how can we make brands grow in the right place. And the right place for brands to grow is we've got to make money. So above the economic threshold for purposeful life, but below the ecological threshold for unsustainable life. So they've got to grow there. So how do we make them grow in a way that the things they make replenish Earth, and then are there other pathways to grow that don't require the making of things? One of my best friends is a guy called Nadir Contractor, who used to run Columbia Music 20 years ago in New York. And his economic model was sell CDs. So he'd get on the phone to Beyonce and say, write an album. We've got to sell CDs at Christmas. Then he'd get on the phone to Destiny's Child's manager and say, promote the album, go on tour. I've got things to sell. And then Napster happened, and then that got scaled by iTunes, and his things disappeared. The CDs were streamed. So he had to pivot his economic model from things to experiences. And now you get this phenomenal Taylor Swift doing $3 billion a year. You've got, you know, ABBA not even turning up and doing $400 million down in Stratford. So you can see that the meaning system of the brand in music, you could pivot from there to things. At this conference I went to was Jacquemus, the designer, just opened a store on Bond Street, queues all the way down there. When I heard the guy talk, I was like blown away. He was just kind of, I wanted to be in his club. You know, I wanted to be part of his brand. I wanted to adopt part of his knowledge. But I couldn't, because for me to do that, it would have to manifest in me buying a shocking pink handbag. and I'm not in the market for a shocking pink handbag, but I'd still like to access his brand. Now, brands will have to open up to enable me to do that. And I'd like to visit his lavender field with him that inspired him. I'd pay for that, but I won't pay for a pink handbag. So I think what we've got to do is sort of, with brands, the thing that's going to shift them is in their physical products have got to become regeneratively sourced, regeneratively manufactured. They've got to have an afterlife design. They've got to have long aesthetic lifespan combined with long durable lifespans. And then they've got to start to look at pathways to growth, that are pathways through the knowledge that they have inherent in the brand, the experiences they have, and the intelligence that they have that they can open source and invite people in. And that's what the book's all about.
Very good. Yes. Well, I think, when did you say it was coming out? Is it April?
It'll be in April. We'll be running a conference with Central St. Martins in April to invite everybody along to understand the principles and also the practices of regenerative brand design. And then in New York, we'll be doing it at Hampton Tech Week.
Okay. Well, hopefully we'll be able to come along to that and cover it a little bit.
Everyone's invited.
Good stuff. And I know we have to wrap up soon, but I just wanted to sort of ask you how much of a sort of educational shift or sort of challenge are you finding to kind of educate brands and business leaders in this space, like in terms of that they need to move towards a more regenerative way of doing things or a mindset? And what do you sort of want to see from the industry going forward next year, maybe?
McKinsey have just reported that, you know, sustainability has dropped out of the top three priorities for CEOs. And that sort of pisses me off. And I'm like, you know, what I want to see is new CEOs. If the CEOs can't see that this is really important and part of their responsibility, then we could try and change their minds once. But if they won't be changed, they need to be changed. When I present our solutions, there's a mixture of relief and exhilaration that there's a solution. There's a way in which we can meet our economic goals and do it with a clear conscience, because we're doing the right things from a corporate brand and product point of view. There's also a mixture of fear and trepidation as they start to become more conscious of the way to do it. So what we want to see is next year from industry is sustainability and regenerative brand design back in the top three of their priorities. We're seeing, you know, and if they need to open their eyes. It's like, I slightly blame Tony Blair for this, because what he did so wonderfully in his time in office was the Good Friday Agreement, right? So the Good Friday Agreement was amazing in its material output, but also in its symbolic output. It gives us hope that intractable things can be reconciled. It gives me hope that precedent can work in Gaza, for example. Where I disagree with him is when he says we shouldn't meet our obligations to go to zero carbon, because that will diminish our competitive advantage until countries like India and China start to meet their obligations. And I couldn't disagree with him more, because if you just take Elon Musk, when Elon Musk went into his first quarter of profitability at Tesla, his dream changed into a reality, and that changed the whole of the automotive sector, shifting to battery and lithium, etc. So as companies and as nations, if we can show that we can go beyond zero and still make a profit, then the world will come to us for our IP. The world will come for us to show them how to do it. So that's what I want to see from CEOs. I want to see them understand the power of influence as well as the bottom line. And from our nations, the power of influence as well as the bottom line. And that's what we're really sort of here to try and bring that consciousness to them.
Well, I wish you all the best in succeeding, and it sounds a very good, I don't know, life, business purpose, or whatever you want to call it, to try and achieve. So I really hope you guys manage to push things to change. That's it, really. But I know we're sort of out of time, but I just wanted to say thank you, Bob, so much for coming on the Media Cat Magazine podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure. Appreciate it. And see you in April.
Yes, brilliant. See you in April.
Cheers.